When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And welcome to episode number 100 of Unformatable, where we take a look at some of the less heralded myths in our beloved franchise's quirky history, because to us, everyone who dons the orange and blue is in some way unformatable. And here we are at episode 100, which I consider something of a milestone, I guess. Can't believe we've recorded this many of these little callbacks to random myths. I decided I wanted to do Terry Leech. I mentioned him before Old Timers Day this summer and was close to doing a pod on him. Chose instead to go with John Stearns, which wound up being fortuitous timing since he passed away shortly after that great moment for him. I kind of thought Stearns was a bit too known and too played too long for the Mets to do a podcast, but when I had originally decided to do Terry Leech, I wanted to kind of reread his book before I did the pod. It was a low-key, enjoyable memoir of an itinerant pitcher with a unique pitching style, kind of like a proto R.A. Dickey or something. And his book, Things Happen for a Reason, subtitled The True Story of an Itinerant Life in Baseball. I guess that's why itinerant was in my head there. Isn't quite the tome that the eloquent and beloved R.A. Dickey's Wherever I Wind Up is, and perhaps that's fitting because Terry Leech didn't quite put together the full season of brilliance that led to one of the most unlikely Cy Young Awards in recent memory, but his story truly seems cut from the same kind of cloth. An enjoyable story, an enjoyable cloth it is at that, as talking about a one-time college fireballer suffering arm problems, needing to reinvent himself, and with perseverance and guile and grishin, and never giving up on the dream of having a moment in the MLB sun, they made it. In Leech's case, making it included being in the thick of a pennant race for a defending world championship squad that was absolutely decimated by injuries. With the best rotation in baseball in rehab, on ice, on the DL, young pitchers perhaps suffering from the added and high-stress innings of a long and arduous postseason in 1986, Terry's season had a season and a career that wound up being unformatable. And today we will look at his long journey to the Mets, his struggles going up and down, and bright moments with them before his incredible 1987 season, which was probably the peak of his time with the Mets. Of course, it was a long road to that 1987 season of glory for Leech. Took a lot of great pitching in the minors and with the Mets and elsewhere for him to keep earning his shot over and over. But without further ado, Terry Hester Leech was born on March 13th, 1954, in Selma, Alabama. I will try to limit the times I say this, but you should really read Leech's memoir if you haven't, as a Mets fan or a baseball fan. I think it's quite the enjoyable read. And don't take my word for it. If you want to listen to noted authors and Mets fans, Paul Auster wrote a lovely foreword to it, recalling a start of Leech's that he attended in 1985, and Jonathan Lethem, among others, provided a lovely blurb for it. It's chock full of great stories, and of course Leech tells his childhood and how he came to baseball and Little League and high school life briefly, but much better than I could. But it's particularly interesting and revelatory for the struggles and tough life and meager pay of the non-bonus top draft pick minor leaguers, sharing couches, no air conditioning in the Southern League, sub-minimum wage checks, etc. Truly recounts those stories and all with aplomb in the book. But before becoming a Met, Leach, and before struggling through the minors with multiple organizations, he grew up in Selma playing baseball. He was steered away from football by his dad, who perhaps knew the dangers of football from playing at Auburn in his life. Leach, in fact, was from a very athletic family, and in the book attributes his athleticism and his competitive drive to that and his need to keep up with his athletic older brothers. He did ultimately attend his dad's alma mater on a baseball scholarship, or a partial scholarship at least, where they converted him from a third baseman to a pitcher, which he took to quickly, going 9-0 with a 1.30 ERA as a sophomore and flashing an electric arm. In the first of many bad breaks, Leach was drafted in the January 76 supplemental draft by the Red Sox. This was apparently voided because of his age at the time of the draft, which I guess would have been under 18. Can't really say what the draft rules were then, but I assume that that was the problem. At any rate, it probably cost him a lot of money. He was drafted in the seventh round of that draft, but couldn't sign, went back to college, and promptly developed elbow problems, which Leach surmised, you know, with modern information as likely being a torn ACL that was undiagnosed at the time. It cost him his velocity and led to him not being drafted thereafter, but Leach, as would be his hallmark, would adapt and doggedly continue working on his command, working on a sinker and slider, and continuing to just hone his pitching craft even without the that primo velocity. He toiled in independent leagues before getting a tryout and ultimately getting signed by the Atlanta Braves in 1976. In 1977, Leach would get assigned to Greenwood in Single A for the Braves organization, where he credited his Greenwood pitching coach, Kenny Rowe, with suggesting that he try adjusting and throwing sidearm in an attempt to get more movement on his pitches. Leach recounts that the change brought immediate and dramatic results as he began to work on becoming the darting sinker and rising slider sidewinding artist we would eventually know and love in Metdom. But again, it would be a long road to get there, although Leach was pretty consistently excellent results-wise in the minor leagues. Obviously a few blips here and there. But the story he portrays in his book is of someone continually overlooked because he didn't, you know, fit the role that, you know, looked the part, as it were, of traditional pitcher. And it would take hours to recount his up and down, you know, nature. He famously didn't make an opening day roster until 1988, I believe, after, you know, his incredible 87 run that we'll look at most in depth. But over parts of 12 minor league seasons, Leach did it all and generally did it well. He went 50-33 over parts of 12 minor league seasons, appearing in 345 games, starting 44. He started, he relieved, he recorded 39 minor league saves through 854 innings, and did all of that consistently to an ERA under 3. When you average out all of his minor league time. Despite that, and despite having good results in AA Savannah and AAA Richmond for the Braves in 79 and 80, at the age of 26, Leach found himself released by the Braves org with a 5-1 record and a 3.21 ERA at AAA that year. Leach would then latch on with a Mets organization pretty devoid of talent at the time and rebuilding, which probably represented an optimal opportunity for him to get chances, although even in a struggling, developing organ like the Mets were in the early 90s, those chances were sporadic, even in Flushing. Ultimately, in 1981, Leach would get to make his major league debut with the Mets. A quirky-looking, curly-haired, not Bartolo-esque, but not exactly your traditional slender, athletic figure, with a whip-like submarine motion that came in just south of sidearm as his knee scraped the ground, it was hard not to root for Terry immediately as a fan. It would not actually be a smooth major league debut for Leach, though. He finally made his major league debut on August 12th, 1981, making him 27 at the time of his debut, when he would finally get to live that dream of coming on in a major league ballgame. He came in relief of Ed Lynch at Wrigley Field after the Mets had scored 3 runs to take a 4-2 lead in the top of the 7th, and perhaps feeling the nerves, who's to say, but Leach gave up singles to the first 2 major league batters he faced. The aforementioned John Stearns did his best to bail him out with a big caught stealing, eliminating one of those base runners, but after a pop-out almost got him out of the inning, Leach would give up a 2-run homer to Mike Lum that would tie the game and give him a blown save in his major league debut in a game in which the Mets would rally to win 7-4. Leach would settle down and settle in, though, going 1-1 with a 2.45 ERA over 35 and third innings, and he would earn his first major league win on September 9th, 1981, in very Leachian fashion. He pitched 3 1/3 innings of scoreless relief in lieu of a struggling, ineffective starter Greg Harris in Pittsburgh against the Pirates. The Mets would rally against Pascual Perez, getting Leach that elusive first major league victory. That first season and ensuing offseason and start of the next season would be a microcosm of what Leach did, what would happen to him, that, again, I don't think we'd have time to go through every transaction. We'd be here all night. But Leach pitched well from a modern or sabermetric perspective. He didn't strike out a ton of batters, but he did limit home runs. Over 35 and a third innings, he allowed only 36 base runners, 12 walks to 16 strikeouts, although his strikeout rate would improve a bit over his career, but allowed only 2 home runs, one in that debut, obviously, in those 35 and a third innings. And not only would he pitch well, but he would not, you know, by his estimation and, you know, probably by, you know, hindsight, be appreciated for his success as he'd continue to have to fight for a roster spot and ride the AAA Major League shuttle for years, despite generally succeeding whenever he'd get those Major League shots. 1982 being a prime example of that, where he would spend most of the year in AAA, where he would go 4-1 with 5 saves and a 2.96 ERA, but would not earn a ton of time in the majors. However, when he did get a shot to make his second career start as a Met, when Rick Ownby came up ill in game 160 on October 1st of 82 in Philadelphia, Leach flashed what he could do when given those shots. In one of the most memorable and best starts in Mets history, the sidewinding Leach threw a 10-inning, one-hit shutout of the Phillies. The Sol hit a triple by Luis Aguayo in the 5th inning. John Denny of the Phillies actually allowed only 1 hit over 9 himself, with Leach matching him and then exceeding him as the Mets scored a run in the top of the 10th, and Leach closed it out. With the game score of 91, Leach had the first one-hitter that a Mets player had thrown since Tom Seaver in 1977. Pete Rose went 0-for-4 with a strikeout in the game, and in a 1984 interview listed Leach among the toughest pitching opponents he had faced. High praise from the disgraced hit king. Also notable, you know, that Rose was a lefty or a switch hitter, and, you know, Leach notoriously was thought of as a sidewinder, as someone who could not be effective against lefties. In another quirk of that game, which is another thing I remember, what a sad life as a child watching game 160 of a desolate Mets season. The umpires had to wear Phillies uniforms and groundskeeper's gear because the umpiring equipment didn't make it to the vet. Leech's thanks and reward for a 10-inning, one-hit shutout. He wouldn't appear again in the major leagues until 1985. He'd spend all of 1983 in Tidewater for the Mets, which was probably frustrating for him, and it was perhaps his worst minor league season statistically, 82 and 83. And you could see where the Mets could be forgiven for thinking that they had gotten the most out of him. But Leech did importantly earn a big ally in the 1983 season, as the then Tidewater manager Davey Johnson appreciated Leech's jack-of-all-trades flexibility and rubber arm, and would ultimately become a bit of a champion, or, you know, give Leech more opportunities than others did. After the 83 season, Leech actually was traded by the Mets for a couple of fringe prospects to the Cubs, who had apparently scouted him and had a lot of interest in him. But according to Leech, the Cubs then changed managers to Jim Frey, who didn't appreciate the sidewinder, and he never really got a chance in Chicago that he thought he would get, leading to Leech being traded again in early April back to the Braves organization. In 84, he pitched okay with the Braves, but got a midseason release and wound up back with the Mets in Tidewater, where he went 11-3 with a 3.34 ERA and would be pretty dominant in Tidewater in 1985, posting a 1.59 ERA before getting recalled to the Mets and back to Davey in June. Again, he'd pitch well in the majors. He would, at the age of 31 in 1985, he went 3-4 with a 2.91 ERA, flashed that versatility that Davey appreciated, 22 games, 4 games started, 1 complete game shutout, 1 save. As befitting that versatile swingman role, he threw 4 huge innings of one-run relief in that epically famous 16-13, 19-inning game, 4th of July game against the Braves that the Mets won at damn near 4 in the morning. His save was another 4-inning outing, 4 scoreless innings against the Expos in relief of a struggling Rick Aguilera. But perhaps the most leechy performance of the year was the one that Auster commemorated in that foreword to Leech's memoir. On August 22, 1985, Sid Fernandez was scheduled to pitch at Shea against the San Francisco Giants. Apparently came up with the flu or wasn't feeling well, according to the foreword. At any rate, Leech, just an hour or two before game start, sitting in the clubhouse in his underwear, learned that he had to start. Went out there and threw a 3-hit shutout against the Giants on something like 88 pitches, I think I read. His second career complete game and shutout, following, of course, that 10-inning masterpiece from 82. But more importantly, no pressure, just kept the Mets a half game in front of the Cardinals at 73-46. Cardinals also won that day to 72-46 in a virtual tie, in which, of course, what was an epic pennant race. And Leech dropped his ERA at the time after the complete game shutout to 1.46. He'd ultimately posted 2.91 ERA on the season, 3-1 with a 2.70 ERA in those 4 spot starts, and really endeared himself to Davey Johnson even further. Remembered him in 83, of course, Davey and the team started calling Leech Jack, as in Jack of all trades. And as you can tell in the memoir and from the famous World Series ring story that we'll get to soon, Leech was, of course, not just appreciated and respected, but seemed very beloved by his teammates and certainly by the fans, with that quirky sidearm delivery and all that grishin. But he may have earned respect and appreciation in 1985, but he still didn't earn himself a job. The season, of course, didn't end as the Mets wanted, as the pennant race with the Cardinals came down to that series in St. Louis, and the 98 wins got them nowhere. But in 1986, the team still had no room on the roster for Leech, as that juggernaut team, I guess I didn't appreciate it at the time. The Mets just seemed so good and it just seemed like a natural progression from 85 to 86, but I guess nothing went wrong in 86. No one got injured, all the pieces clicked, and that meant there was no room for the that kind of spare part jack-of-all-trades Leach, who was invited to camp as a non-roster player, which he didn't appreciate after his successful 85, and spent all but 5 weeks of the year in Tidewater. He did expect to get called up when the rosters expanded in September to the 86 team, but then late in the season he dislocated his shoulder in a home plate collision in a AAA game, endemic, I think, of his competitive nature, going for it, and back when home plate collisions were a thing, even though he was a pitcher. Leach was actually not given a World Series ring after 86 by the Mets organization. It's mentioned in the memoir, and I think even at the time of the publication of the book, the issue had not been resolved, but again, as a mark of how much his teammates cared for him and appreciated him, his teammates fought for it, and apparently Randy Myers split the cost of Terry Leach's World Series ring with Fred Wilpon, as if we needed yet another reminder of how horribly cheap and petty and annoying the Wilpons could be. It looked like the same old story would repeat itself for Leach in 87. Non-roster invite was going to get sent down to AAA, but injuries, Doc Gooden's famous day in Smithers' drug rehab clinic, all Roger McDowell injury, continued pitching injuries, David Cone hurt himself during the season, gave Leach an opportunity, and he turned it into a golden one. Leach got 3 wins out of the bullpen over the first kind of quarter of the year, the first one coming May 22nd against the Dodgers. The Mets, Leach only pitched 2/3 of an inning and got a win. The Mets moved up to 19-20. They really struggled early that year. You know, perhaps a little World Series hangover, or you know, maybe just a lot of young pitchers having exhausted themselves, thrown too many innings. People love to look at the 86 Mets and just slap it with, I think, lazy revisionist history of, like, you know, they all just wasted their chance on drugs. But I think, you know, people overlook the fact that, you know, Doc Gooden threw 1,000 innings before he turned 24, and a lot of those other young pitchers, that was a long, exhausting, strenuous postseason. And perhaps it was just natural attrition that I don't think we appreciated as much or were as aware of back then. At any rate, by the end of May, Leach was 3-0 out of the bullpen with a 2.37 ERA before, I think, a David Cone injury opened up a spot in the rotation. In his memoir, Leach described himself at one point, "I'm an insurance policy in case someone gets hurt," and people just kept getting hurt. In a June 1st rematch against the Dodgers, Leach started against the vaunted Fernando Valenzuela, went 6 innings, allowing 1 unearned run and getting the victory, moving him to 4-0. And he was off and running. His next start was a no decision where he pitched 6 innings and allowed only 2 earned runs against the Cubs. And then he went 8 innings in back-to-back starts, getting victories over the Expos and the Phillies, surrendering only 3-2 runs in those 8 innings. Even worked in a relief appearance between those 2 starts, because that's what the rubber-armed Leach would do. Then on July 2nd, he went to 7-0 with a complete game 2-hit shutout over the Cincinnati Reds. The rallying Mets moved to 42-35. Within 5 games of the front-running Cardinals. And as for Terry Leach, he dropped his ERA to 2.13, and his record ran to 7 wins and no losses. When he won his next start against the Braves on July 7th, Leach went to 8-0, and the All-Star break was approaching, and fans were clamoring for the side armor to get a shot at the All-Star game. Davey had a shot to choose him, but thought that Leach, who was pitching much more than he was used to, needed the rest, and Leach did not, sadly, go to Oakland for the All-Star game that year. But while he had a couple of clunkers where he got no decisions in there, he also earned a couple of more wins, and on August 11th, when he went 8 innings against the Expos, earning the win, he moved to 10-0, still, I believe, a Met record for wins from the start of the season. The Cubs would finally hand him a loss in his next start, a 7-3 defeat at Wrigley, dropping him to 10-1. Despite all that success, Leach would make only one more start as some of the injured Mets began to return, and he moved transitioned back to his bullpen role. But that 11-1 record, I believe, still the best winning percentage in team history. Leach threw 131 and a third innings that year, put up a career high for him, 2.2 WAR, according to Baseball Reference. Apologies, I'm just looking online. He joined the rotation when Rick Aguilera got injured, and then he lost his spot in the rotation when David Cone returned from the DL later in the year. The Mets, of course, came up short painfully in 1987, just missing a chance to pass the Cardinals and get a chance to try and defend their world championship. Leach, for all of his efforts, had to have knee surgery after the season, but for the first time seemed to have a role all but assured in 1988, made the opening day roster, and pitched well, going 7-2 with a 2.54 ERA in 52 games and over 92 innings. And he pitched and pitched well in that 1988 NLCS against the Dodgers, throwing 5 scoreless innings, striking out 4 and allowing 4 hits and a walk. One interesting thing I thought in the memoir, and it probably wouldn't have really mattered because the Mets lost that game 6-0, but Leach seemed bothered that Doc Gooden came in relief of Ron Darling when he struggled early in that Game 7. Leach, you know, thought it made more sense for him to come in since he was used to getting ready and pitching quickly and coming in relief, and Doc had never done it, which was an interesting point and, you know, again speaks, I think, to Leach's competitive fire, although it was hard at the time not to want Doc Gooden coming out of the bullpen. And, you know, it's exciting, and it usually works when, you know, you have your Max Scherzers coming in for the Nationals and whatnot, but unfortunately it did not work for the Mets in that occasion. It's Gooden followed Darling and struggling, and the Mets once again lost a chance for a second World Series title for that great 80s team. Leach began the 89 season with the Mets, but in June was traded to the Kansas City Royals for a minor leaguer, I believe ostensibly so the Mets could bring David West up, prospect, pitch out of the bullpen. 89, of course, was a rough year. Saw the Mets part with a lot of big pieces of that World Series core. Roger McDowell, Rick Aguilera, Mookie Wilson, all got traded. Lenny Dykstra, you know, with McDowell. And, you know, Leach was a smaller piece of that, but again, I think someone whose teammates felt was an integral part of the team and the clubhouse, and, you know, was a fan favorite, just like some of those, in a different way, but it looks like some of those aforementioned Mets. Despite the 87 joyride and accolades, you know, it just seemed like it's always a struggle for him, and, you know, it wasn't appreciated, and, you know, even at the time of the trade, well, the Mets made a lot of confusing decisions in 1989, trying desperately to salvage the end of that near-dynastic run. But the underappreciated Leach went on to more success in baseball. He did struggle in Kansas City in 1989, but then latched on with the Minnesota Twins and became a key member of their bullpen in 1990 and 1991. In 1991, the Twins, of course, went worst to first, and unlike in the 88 NLCS, Leach was entrusted as a key member of the bullpen with some key outs in the 1991 playoffs and World Series. None more so than in Game 3 of the World Series against the Braves. Leach came in. Tom Kelly brought him in to pitch to Mark Lemke, who was not known as a huge hitter, but I believe he had won the NLCS MVP that year. I know he was having an incredible postseason, and Leach actually said he came in with the bases loaded and struck out Lemke to get the Twins out of a jam. Leach said that he was tempted to ask Tom Kelly, "You know what you're doing here? You're bringing in a sidearmer against a left-hander. You never do that," which was interesting, but also amusing to me, since Leach always fought that, you know, resented that implication that he was only good against righties, and I think his success starting, you know, proved that he could pitch to both batters, although statistically his splits were much better against right-handers and average against lefties. But interesting, in that pressure-packed situation where he did come through, his initial thought was, "Wait, why are you bringing me in here?" But Leach earned that World Series ring, which would I guess is the second he earned, but the first he received, thanks to Fred Wilpon. But he did not earn another season with the Twins. You know, just the story of that underappreciated life. Was granted free agency, not re-signed by the Twins, latched on with the Expos, and did not make the team, was released before spring training, and signed on with the Chicago White Sox, and at the age of 38 in 1992, proceeded to have one of the best seasons of his career. Went 6-5 with a 1.95 ERA in 73 2/3 innings out of the White Sox pen. He credited his mixing in a changeup that his White Sox pitching coach taught him to helping give him a new wrinkle. And in fact, it matched the 2.2 WAR he had in 87 with the Mets as his best statistical season. Unfortunately for Leach, his elbow problems recurred in 93, got into just 14 games, and that was the last of his major league career. Made comeback attempts with the Tigers in 94 and 95, but never made it back to the majors, or never got another shot in the majors after 93. Whether guts or guile or that sidearm delivery, even with elbow problems, unlike a lot of pitchers who, you know, those last couple of seasons are painful numbers-wise, he threw up a 2.81 ERA over his 16 innings in 1993. And in fact, if you look at Leach's statistical numbers over his career, they're pretty impressive, particularly the traditional numbers. He put up 10 WAR over parts of 11 major league seasons. Pretty impressive for a reliever. Went 38-27. He appeared in 376 games, 21 of them starts, 12 of them in that epic 1987 season. Also recorded 10 saves over his career, many of them of that like 3-4 inning variety due to his flexibility. And he threw 3 complete games and 3 shutouts. I believe we kind of covered them all. 82, 10 inning, 1 hitter. His 85 appearance in relief of Sid Fernandez, and the shutout of the Reds in the middle of his 10-game winning streak. He threw exactly 700 major league innings, gave up 688 hits, walked 197, struck out 331. And I think those, the strikeout numbers, of course, his ERA was 3.15. His career FIP was 3.45, so not that far off, but I know the lack of strikeouts probably hurt him a bit insofar as the 10 WAR for his career, 5.5 of which were recorded as a Met over parts of 7 seasons. Just a quote from his book, "Baseball is a frustrating game at times. Other times it's exciting, and then again strange, even kind of deep. Spending your life in it, you'll find insecurity, confusion, joy, boredom, friendship, mistrust, surprise, despair, hope, and pain." So much happens, you just have to be conscious of the fact that you're not in control of any of it, and from that point it does make sense, in a funny kind of way. Very eloquent way to make sense of a career where Terry Leach was traded 3 times, released 4 times, spent parts of 10, 11 seasons in the minor leagues, and didn't make an opening day roster until he was 33 years old, yet still managed to pitch on 2 World Series winning teams, ultimately winning himself 2 World Series rings, and etching himself a memorable, unformidable little corner in Mets history. A wonderful Mets career, a wonderful World Series coda, belated appreciation. And I'm really glad that he ultimately did get that much-deserved World Series ring from the Mets organization. Terry Leach, truly unformidable, and so are all of you. I want to thank you, all of you who've listened to any of these. 100 feels like a very nice milestone to me. For the rest of the offseason, we're going to play around a tiny bit with the formula, maybe look at some almost Mets that were rumored to come here and never quite did. The endless Manny Ramirez to the Mets rumors come to mind, but we'll probably try to think of more off-season ones than in-season ones. But at any rate, thanks for listening to Unformettable. Please go to AmazingAvenue.com for more Mets-related content. You can follow Amazing Avenue on all your socials, and you can find this and all of our amazing pods wherever you get your podcasts. Original music by Bunga. I'm on Twitter at WolfRR, WOLFFRR, and the show is at Unformidable. Thank you, and as always, let's go Mets.